So last week, in this fall in general, I've been wanting to do talks and reflections that are really on how we deepen our practice so that it's not just something when we feel good that we can quiet down a little, but when things are difficult, how do we really bring the difficulties into our spiritual path and wake up through them? Last week I spent some time exploring that with physical illness, since that's been a prime top ten, one of the top ten for me recently. And I'd like to expand that to what is really underneath with physical illness, or anything underneath where the real suffering is, which is fear. How do we work with fear? And I was thinking I'd do this in two parts. And I really could spend the next decade doing it. But we'll start with doing two parts. And really, it's an inquiry, how do we relate when we get scared? And the understanding is that the very ways we run away, and we all have a kind of our favorite strategies, totally flavor our experience of living. And that when we begin to meet fear or vulnerability with presence, it really reveals a love and an awareness that's our true home, and it reveals our connectedness with each other in a very living way. I wanted to read an article that has been going around since last week, entitled "What the Amish Are Teaching America." I'm actually just going to read a little bit of it, but I found so much moving about the response to the tragedy in their community. It says, the evening of the shooting, Amish neighbors from the Nickel Mines community gathered to process their grief with each other and mental health counselors. As of that evening, three little girls were dead. Eight were hospitalized in critical condition. One other has died since. According to reports by counselors who attended the grief session, the Amish family members grappled with a number of questions. Do we send our kids to school tomorrow? What if they want to sleep in our beds tonight? Is that okay? But one question they asked might surprise outsiders. What, they wondered, can we do to help the family of the shooter? Plans were already underway for a horse and buggy caravan to visit Charles Carl Roberts' family. That's the man that shot the little girls in the schoolhouse. To visit his family with offers of food and condolences. The Amish, it seems, don't automatically translate their grieving into revenge. Meanwhile, the United States culture from which the Amish are isolated is moving in the other direction, increasingly exacting revenge for crimes and punishing violence with more violence. Our patterns of punishment and revenge are fundamentally at odds with the deeper values of common humanity that the tragic experience of the Amish are helping to reveal. I was trying to explore in myself why I was so moved by their response. You know, and I many times examine in my own life, you know, if something, when somebody hurts me, do I have the quality of presence to really be, stay right here and have my heart open, or do I go into, in some way, judging, blaming, wanting to hurt? And when I examine it, you know, where does revenge come from? Where does the blaming come from? Where does it come from that we lash out or that we start invasions and wars? And it's fear. That rather than stay with the enormity of the hurt and the loss, it's easier to go into trying to control things and get back at someone. The biochemistry of anger and blame is a kind of relief from the incredible vulnerability of just grief. So it takes an enormous presence to be with what's here rather than react out of fear, the fear that it's too much, I can't be with this. So many people I talk to are registering. It's kind of like our nervous system's registering how much fear is in our culture and what it's doing to the world. And not just our culture, of course. We're in a dance with other fearful cultures. Probably a lot of you saw the figures in the paper today from that MIT-funded study. It was overseen by Hopkins that said that there were 655,000 more deaths in Iraq than there would have been had we not entered. Our fear-driven behaviors create enormous suffering, and we see it in our personal life. We know about that. So the truth is, for each of us, we're all navigating with fear. The very nature of being alive in a body that's impermanent, with everything unreliable and undependable, is that we're living with fear in our nervous systems. What I'd like to explore this week and next week is how we can meet that with a wise heart, so that when fear arises, rather than react to ourselves and our world in a way that we're armored, contracted, in a trance, and I'm going to talk more about the trance of fear, we can actually have that experience of fear rising in us be a kind of invitation to deepen presence and really discover the awareness and the love that's our nature. That it's an invitation. It's not like we try to get rid of the fear so we can actually do our path and our practice. It's like it is embedded in the path. So first, just to say that fear is not a mistake, and it's not wrong. It's completely natural and necessary. And being without fear means that we're brain dead. You know, it's that basic. You know, strong fear arises from our limbic system. It's so we can survive. And they describe it as it's responsible for the four Fs: feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproduction. So the Buddha described fear as the universal conditioning that arises out of our basic perception of separateness. That if this organism perceives separateness, which it does, there's going to be clinging onto what will enhance us and pushing away what feels threatening. So I like this from the Vedas. In the beginning, there was simply the absolute, oneness, the mind or awareness of the absolute present in the infinite. Then within the mind of the absolute, there arose the thought or perception, I am. And immediately following that thought, there came fear. So all life forms, and this is from the earliest single-celled creatures, have some perception of self in here and world out there and some sort of a membrane or some information on what self is. And the primal mood of the separate self is fear. There's an apprehension of vulnerability, of impermanence, and a clinging to existence. And so hand in hand with fear, the way we move through existence is by trying to control things so as to keep on surviving and keep this particular form in existence and avoid dissolution of this form. So it's control. As soon as we feel fear, we go into control in some form. And our nervous system's rigged to be vigilant, to scan for what can go wrong. That's part of controlling, is this vigilance, to scan for what threatens, to remember past unpleasant and anticipate future unpleasant. And it's in children, it's in adults, it's in all creatures. One of my favorite little stories, some of you are going to remember it in here, on a summer evening during a violent thunderstorm, a mother was tucking her son in bed. She was about to turn off the light when he asked with a tremor in his voice, Mommy, will you sleep with me tonight? The mother smiled and gave him a reassuring hug. I can't, dear, she said. I have to sleep in Daddy's room. A long silence was broken at last by a shaky little voice. The big sissy. So Rather, I'm not going to talk a lot about this part, but fear is an evolutionary message necessary for survival. It gives us information saying, you know, take care of ourselves. And our problem is that we get fixated in an overreaction. It's out of control. It's proliferated. So we spend way more time with our body tightening and our mind getting busy and worrying and anticipating than we need to. Some of you might remember, there's a kind of description that we have 60,000 thoughts a day, and 95% of them we had yesterday. And there's this familiar cocoon of thoughts we're living in, and a lot of them have to do with what's going to go wrong or what is wrong, and they then generate the biochemistry of fear, of fight or flight, which is great if there's a danger to flee from or to fight against. But there's so much else. And the biochemistry of fight and flight does not go with the experience of open-heartedness, our creativity, our enjoying a sunset, our feeling of wonder. It just doesn't go. So it's a biochemistry we mainline on. And another story, a little boy said to his mom, "Mom, just pretend that there's 15 hungry tigers surrounding you. What are you going to do?" And she kind of thought about it and said, "Well, I don't know. What do I do?" And he said, "Stop pretending." You know? So I like that, because whether we call it pretending or imagining or fixating on the what's wrong, it is our habit. And we're living, sometimes we're not aware of it. I think we are so used to the biochemistry of fear that it's only when it spikes in certain ways that we go, "Oh gosh, I'm scared." I think that our familiar sense of our being, moving it through the world, is one of, at least to some degree, the grip of anxiety is to some degree not in consciousness. It's so familiar. So it's interesting. In any moment to pause and really check in and just sense, you know, is anything wrong right now? Just to stop during the day. And you'll notice, and I invite you all, I can say I notice that there's some assumption that things aren't quite right and that I need to tense against what's going to come or strain to make something happen. There's some assumption or presumption of not okay, and our body's holding it tightly. So the truth is that these organisms are going to die, and if we're living in a self-centered kind of thought realm, that behind the lines there's always this recognition that this thought, this body-mind is only here for a certain amount of time. And Rumi, the poet, put it in a way I think is really powerful. He said, "Whatever comes into being gets caught up in being, drunkenly forgetting its way back." We get caught up in this idea of separate selfness, and we forget. We forget a larger kind of belonging. Now, for many of us, fear comes and goes, but fear becomes suffering. I talked about this last week, the difference between pain and suffering. Fear becomes suffering when our identity gets possessed by it, when our sense of who we are really becomes defined by the feelings of fear, when our behaviors are driven by fear, our thoughts are driven by fear. That's what I call the trance of fear. Okay, so the experience, the affect of fear comes and goes, but it's a trance of fear when it's really defining our daily experience. And we know what that's like when we get caught in that tangle of fearful thoughts, when our body is tight, when the world's small. We're living in a very small world. And this is actually the nature of trance. It's a kind of body-mind reactivity when we're convinced something's wrong, and we're forgetting the vastness of being. You know, we're forgetting love and beauty and our relatedness. and the vastness of the world. So maybe just for a moment as a check-in, let me just ask you, and I like to do this, just to kind of look back over today. And just close your eyes and just review some of the main currents of what your day was about. And let the lens be how much of today's experience was flavored by anxiety about a kind of a worried sense of what I needed to do, what was coming up, if I was doing well enough, what others were thinking of me. So subtle or not so subtle, how much of today's experience was contracted in some trance of things aren't quite okay or things are really not okay? When you'd like, you can open your eyes, but we're going to explore more what it means for each of us here to, because we all do it. We all go into the trance of fear some. To the extent we're not free, our world is contracted by some notion of, I'm not okay, things aren't okay. We're forgetting. We've forgotten our way back. So the question is, what does it mean to be free from fear, or to experience fearlessness or courageousness? And it doesn't mean that we don't have the thoughts or stories that something's going to go wrong. It doesn't mean we don't have those unpleasant physical sensations. That's not what it means. Freedom from fear means that when fear arises, it doesn't take over our sense of who we are. There's some remembering of something bigger. There's some remembering of our heart and awareness. I think of it, and I talk about it often in terms of waves in an ocean, that when fear arises, there's some sense, okay, these are waves, and they're very unpleasant thoughts and feelings. But there's a sense of the who I am is this ocean. I'm the, as I think it's that Ajahn Chah says, the one who knows, that I am the awareness that's aware of these waves. So we include the waves, but we're not limited to them. The poet Rumi puts it this way. He says, be empty of worrying. Think of who created thought. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. So awakening from the trance of fear is really awakening into widening rings of being. It's a shift in identity from the self that's plagued with fear to a sense of the awareness that just senses fear coming, fear going. Aung San Suu Kyi says, the only real prison is fear, and the only real freedom is freedom from fear. Now, what sustains and perpetuates the trance of fear when fear arises and we start getting small and stuck is that rather than just opening to the fear, the vulnerability, the grief, what's here, we each, as I mentioned, have our own set of strategies. They're pretty universal, but we have our own particular cluster of how we run away. And every one of us has these strategies of how we run away. And we have external ones that we have fear-driven behaviors where I think probably the most well-used strategy when we're scared is we get busy. We speed up. Fear and speeding up go together. I mean, some people freeze. That's not completely true. But a lot of, in this culture, when we get scared, we speed up. We get busy. We try to achieve. We try to prove ourselves. We try to fix things. A lot of times when we're afraid, we lash out and blame. There is a real relationship between fear and lashing out. We either blame ourselves or blame others, but fear quickly converts into anger and blaming. Again, we're trying to control. Internally, when we get afraid, there is a contraction of the body and the mind and the emotional body that has been called the body of fear. If, when fear arises and we start contracting, we can use our mindfulness to recognize the body of fear, we can cut the conditioning that perpetuates it. So that's what we'll cover tonight. Like, really, how do you recognize it? In your life, during your day, how can you pause and go, oh, okay, this is the trance of fear. I'm subscribing to a small self. I've gotten caught in limiting stories. This body's tightening. How do we recognize it? And we'll just to begin by saying, physically, the first foundation of mindfulness is to begin to scan and sense, even right now, is your body tight in a habitual way? Take a moment. It's so interesting when we come back. Just come back again. Just maybe close your eyes and just feel your body. Can you sense the places that are kind of just by habit tightening? For many, it's the shoulders are up and forward a little, or the head forward. Some, the back gets hunched and tightened, or the chest sinks. You know, when we're young, a child is relaxed and awake in their body, but over the years of fear, of defending against vulnerability, there's a chronic tightening. And certain parts of the body are how we tighten, our belly. If you really start paying careful attention, you'll notice the layers of armoring in the belly. And to begin to soften the belly is actually, for some, an opening to real vulnerability. Have some of you noticed that? If you soften the belly, you actually can feel more emotion. The wall or armoring of muscle in the belly actually kind of is to cut off some of the feeling that's really strong and vulnerable in that area. So the physicality of the body of fear is this tightening, and we're tensing against, you know, the danger around us. And we develop a permanent suit of armor. When we get older, different ages, things start, we get really chronic problems with the body. It's because of this habitual tightening. It's outside of our awareness a lot of the time. And when we start deepening in mindfulness, it's so interesting that you can say, okay, just relax and begin to let go. But if you check back even like a half minute later or a minute later, there's a recontraction again. So a lot of our practice is to keep on arriving over and over again and just softening and noticing, giving some space for what's here. And the more you notice the habitual clenching, the less you're caught in it. The more there is this kind of capacity just to let go of it. Okay, so that's the body of fear physically. And then, of course, there's the mental body of fear. And that's the one that most of us are pretty familiar with when we just get caught in ongoing kind of circular thinking and worrying. Most of you know that. I tell this a lot, the telegram the Jewish mom sends to her son, you know, start worrying, details to follow, right? You know, and it's so perfect. I mean, it's like we are just worried, we're waiting for some, anticipating something to go wrong, you know, details to follow. So we are planning, figuring out, we're always trying to figure out, you know, how to make sure that things won't go wrong. We're trying to anticipate. And that gets us in trouble. Many of you know personally when you're in relationships, if you anticipate someone's not going to like you or accept you, then the very behaviors that come out of that fear, out of that story of they're not going to like me, make it all come true, right? There's a great story that I read about an Indian tribe that describes how it's autumn and the Indians on this remote reservation want their new chief to tell them whether the winter's going to be really cold and how much they need to get ready to protect themselves. And since he's from a chief from modern society, he's never been taught the old secrets of really knowing, intuiting, and he looked at the sky and he couldn't tell what the weather was going to be. But just to be on the safe side, you know, he said, yeah, it's going to be cold. You guys, get worried, get running, get going. You know, so they collected some wood to be prepared. But he also, being a practical guy, gets this idea and he goes to a phone booth and calls the National Weather Service and says, is this coming winter going to be cold? And the response, it looks like this winter is going to be quite cold indeed. So the meteorologist tells him that. And so the chief goes back to his people and tells them to collect even more wood in order to be prepared. Bad winter ahead. A week later, he calls the weather service again. Is it going to be a very cold winter? Yes, the man at the National Weather Service replies. It's definitely going to be a very cold winter. Again, the chief goes back to his people and orders them to collect every scrap of wood they can find. They're running scared now. 2 weeks later, he calls the National Weather Service again. Are you absolutely sure the winter is going to be very cold? Absolutely, the man replied. It's going to be one of the coldest winters ever. How can you be so sure? The chief asked. The weatherman replied, the Indians are collecting wood like crazy. So this is the storyline. The main storyline that we live with that generates fear is how we're going to fail personally. That's the main one. I talk a lot about our anxiety about imperfection. Our fear of how we're going to fall short is what keeps on creating the biochemistry of fight or flight. Our fear of how we're going to fall short makes us blame others, blame ourselves, cover ourselves, not show who we are. So one of the main practices in seeing the trance of fear is seeing the stories we're believing about ourselves. And I find that maybe one of the greatest breakthroughs that people have when they're waking up on this path is realizing, I don't have to believe my stories. I don't have to believe my beliefs. One woman in New England who's come to a number of retreats I've taught up there, 78-year-old woman, in the last handful of years has become more and more obsessed with losing cognitive capacities and just not being able to function well. And at the last retreat I taught up in New England this summer, she came to me, she said, Tara, you always talk about believing our stories, and I didn't know what you were talking about. And I realized I have completely subscribed to this story that, you know, it's downhill, it's going to get worse, and I'm just a deficient person who's losing it. And she said, so now I've been doing this thing when I'm sitting, is that this, I'll start, you know, thinking of what I have to do today and getting the fears of how I'm going to embarrass myself by not, you know, remembering a word or not finding my way somewhere. And she'll go, and then she says, and then I'll say, oh, that's my story about my deficiency. And she says, and I kind of tuck it into a little place that, you know, just to realize it's not who I am. It's just a story. And she said, it's the first time I've really started to touch what I think the Buddhists are calling freedom. We don't have to believe our stories. And when we begin to recognize the trance of fear, what we're recognizing a lot is that we have these basic stories and beliefs about what's wrong with us and what's going to go wrong. And if we're believing them, we're suffering. Again, let's just take a moment. I'd like just to have you check in and sense a little bit about this for right now. You might reflect a bit on, let a situation come to mind that brings up fear or anxiety for you. And it might be something at work where you're afraid of falling short or that something could go wrong. Or something maybe with people you're involved with. Maybe feeling fear of falling short as a parent or being rejected in a relationship, or maybe that's an important relationship is not going to work. Or that you'll never be able to change something that's going on that's really hurtful, maybe an addiction. So just sense the fear. And take some time to sense really what's most frightening to you. What's really the sense of what's going to go wrong, or the worst thing about that? Might ask yourself, what am I really believing here about myself, about my life? You know, what's the most core belief you can notice? And if you come up with one and it doesn't feel right, you might say, what is it about that that's the worst part? What am I really believing? For some, it'll be that I'll eventually blow it. I just am going to always blow it eventually. Or that no one could really love me. Or that I'll never really be able to be happy. You know, what is the belief that really kind of locks in the fear? And if you're having a hard time finding it, don't worry. It's really the invitation is to let that be part of what you begin to become mindful of, just to ask the question, what am I believing? Now, if you have a sense of, well, here's a belief. I'm believing that maybe I'm not lovable. That's such a universal one. Then you might even sense, is it true? I mean, do I really know that this is true? Can I be absolutely certain that this is truth? You might say yes, that feels absolutely certainly true, but do you really know it's true? You might ask yourself, what's it like to believe this? What's it like in my body when I'm believing this? The body of fear, what's it like? Again, this is not always easy to connect with, but just to sense some ways to inquire mindfully. Now here's an important one. What would it be like if you didn't have this belief, if you didn't believe the belief? Just sense, it takes courage to check this one out. But what would it be like? Just try it for a moment. If you didn't have this belief, you didn't believe it, it was floating around there, but you just didn't buy in. Just a glimmer. What would it be like? Again, this is Rumi saying, move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. Can we let go of our certainty in the limiting beliefs and just stay open? Okay, so opening your eyes. So we've covered some elements of the trance of fear. We've covered how the trance of fear gets us tight in our bodies. How the trance of fear is characterized by thoughts of what's going to go wrong. What's going to go wrong with me? Beliefs in a limited self. The trance of fear is also characterized by emotions, which are the coming together of the thoughts and feelings in the body. For some of you, you might have had the sense of, if you had a belief, that the body felt it was true. It didn't matter what you told yourself. Some of you notice that. It's like you can play with it. You can say, no, that's not true. But your body feels personal badness. Usually fear and shame go together. When we're afraid, we feel in some way like something's wrong with us. In some fundamental way, we're flawed. And it feels, and it's a shameful thing. It's like it's a personal weakness to have fear. So then we feel bad about ourselves, and that locks, the shame locks in the fear. So this is the emotions of the trance of fear. The sense of in the body, a feeling of badness, of unpleasantness. When we begin to be mindful, when we begin to notice, oh, okay, the feeling of shame, these thoughts, this tightness, the very awareness of it allows us to not be so identified. And this is the magic of mindfulness. It said that seeing is freeing. If you can begin to identify this trance, you're not so caught in it. Now, Pema Chodron talks about, in terms of a big squeeze, that we begin to sense daily how we get entrapped in these ideas and this biochemistry of a separate self. And we wouldn't be here. Not one of you would be here if you didn't have some intuitive sense that who you are is larger. Like that 78-year-old woman, that these stories are here, but they're not me. This, even this biochemistry is here, but there's something larger, something truer. So in this last part of tonight's talk, I want to describe how we begin to move into that freedom. And next week I'm going to go into a lot more in terms of our practices. But I would like to share a story that I heard about Ajahn Chah, who was working with Ajahn Chah is a Thai forest monk who died about 8 years ago, who's really been a great inspiration to many Western Buddhists. And in his biography, he told another monk, a Western monk, Ajahn Amaro, about the story was told by Ajahn Amaro, actually, the way I heard it, how Ajahn Chah had a total terror of ghosts. So this was the fear he was dealing with, and a fear of corpses. And even after being a monk for a long time, he had not been able to face this fear. It was just absolutely huge. And just to say that in Thailand, the fear of ghosts is very deep in the culture. So many people of all different strata and so on, it's just kind of across the board, there's just a fear of ghosts. So it's just a terrifying, it was very terrifying to him, but he decided he needed to confront it. It was like, he's on this path, he's going for freedom, and he knew he had to confront it. And so he went to the burning grounds right outside the village he was visiting and camped there for several days. And during this time, there were a couple of funerals and cremations. And he would he stayed camping there because this is the place to face his fear of ghosts. And during the first few nights, his mind would start screaming at him. His mind would scream, "Don't be ridiculous. Don't do this. It's not good for your samadhi. Be reasonable. You know, maybe you can do this next year. Maybe another time when your practice is more together." But he willed himself to stay there. And now, this might not seem like a big deal to us, you know, camping out and facing ghosts, but if you remember 1984, there was room 101, and that's the room where, for any of us, it's like our very worst terror, you know. So this was his. And so the second night, it was that he was camping out, it was towards midnight, and that's when he heard footsteps that were coming louder and closer, and his eyes were closed, and this fear in him was rising up, you know, becoming intolerable. So I'll read to you. In his mind's eye, he could see the charred body. He could see a skeleton with guts hanging out, the scored bits of flesh hanging off. And as he felt this rank mess of flesh walking towards him, he told himself, "Don't believe it. This is just your imagination. Stop. Be still. Let go of fear." In the meantime, the footsteps were getting closer and closer. Then he heard the steps going around him and around him, thump, 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 circling around again and again. By this time, he was in a state of white, hot fear. He had gone beyond anxiety. His body was locked, solid, and sweating bullets. He was absolutely rigid. Then this presence came and stood right in front of him. Ajahn Chah was still determined to keep his eyes closed, not even peek. At this point, he was so completely fear-stricken, it burst. The fear system was going at absolutely full force when suddenly he had the remembering. All these years I've been reciting, the body is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perceptions are impermanent. The body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. So he wasn't just afraid, he was also very concentrated and fully present. Then the insight flashed into his awareness. Even if this is some terribly ghoulish monster that is going to attack me, all that it can attack is that which is not me. All that it can harm is the body, the feelings, the perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. That is the only stuff that can get damaged, and that's not me, that's not self. That which knows all of these cannot be touched. Then instantly the feelings of terror evaporated. It was like switching on a light. It disappeared completely, and he went into an incredibly blissful state. He went straight from total dukkha, pain and incandescent fear, to extraordinary bliss. His mind was alert. And as that happened, he heard the footsteps, thump, 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 getting fainter. Eventually, the footsteps disappeared. He never found out their source. Ajahn Chah sat there without moving until dawn. During the night, it poured. Tears of rapture ran down his face and mixed with the rain. Nothing in the world could have moved him. Comparing that experience of freedom from fear with the abject terror of the first half of the night burnt into him the fact that the Buddha is our true refuge. The Buddha mind is our refuge. That is the safe place. Or as the first Sokni Rinpoche said, there's nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. And he realized, that is it. Regardless of the situation, no matter what I meet, it is just a matter of doing this, of remembering this, remembering the awareness that's our true home. So what freedom? You know, what really freedom in the face of fear? And it's two things. One, he had the courage to stay. He faced it. He did not use any of the strategies, any of the, you know, kind of convincing himself that it was okay to wait a year or to get busy thinking about it. He just stayed and faced it. That's number one. The second is what we call taking refuge. he took refuge in awareness, in the awareness that was bigger than any thought, any bodily feeling, any anything. He took refuge in what's called Buddha nature. The thing when we're afraid we most need is a feeling of safety, and we grab onto false refuges, because nothing works if we're really facing the truth that we're going to die. So he took refuge in true nature, in the awareness, in the space and wakefulness of awareness that really is our home. I'm not this body. I'm not these feelings, these thoughts. So the training that we do is to recognize the trance where we're identified as a small self that's oppressed by fear and trying to hold intensely onto this life, and recognize that trance in a way that allows us to re-inhabit the fullness of our being, re-inhabit what's truly safe, which is awareness and love. So the practice, it's presence, really being with. I described at the beginning with the Amish, and it's true for all of us, that in the moments that instead of reacting, we have the courage to just stay with what's here, we discover a quality of heart and tenderness and vastness that connects us with the whole world. That is the gift of fear. It doesn't happen right away. Sometimes we open to fear and we get banged around and we feel just even more fearful. And sometimes it's not even appropriate to open to fear. We're just too fragile and we'll get re-traumatized. So there's a wisdom. There's a pacing to it. The message here is not just in any given moment, just open wide to the vulnerability. But eventually, that's the message. Eventually, to begin to learn to be quiet, to not believe the thoughts, to feel what's here, and to offer ourselves into that refuge of truth and awareness is what frees us. The challenge is we have so many habits of leaving, of trying to get rid of the fear. The poet Rilke says, how we squander our hours of pain. How we squander our hours of pain. How we gaze beyond them into the bitter duration to see if they have an end. Though they are really seasons of us, our winter. So if we're waiting for our fear to go away, if we're bargaining with our fear, then we won't discover that pure and vast presence that can hold all fears. So what I'd like to do is next week really explore the different practices that help us to stay, because it's hard and it's humbling. And we do keep on wanting the fear to go away. So how can we really gain the power of that presence? And I know some of you are going to be part of our Saturday day long, where we'll kind of deepen that inquiry of really how do you stay with what's difficult. But I'd like to end tonight with just a very short meditation, very, very short. But again, just invite you to come sitting in a way that lets you feel awake and relaxed. Just give you a chance to practice a little with what we've talked about tonight. And just first arrive. Know that you're here. Maybe take a few full breaths. And let this be a pause of arriving. And as we did earlier, the invitation is to bring to mind a situation that you'd like more freedom in, a situation that brings up fear. And as well as you can, let yourself go inside the situation and sense what really stirs up the fear. Maybe as we did earlier, what is it you're believing or anticipating? What's the worst part of the situation? What are you maybe afraid of about yourself and how you'll do? Or what's going to happen to you? And just sense how your body is living with this, how the trance of fear is in the body. Can you sense where you get tight or numb? For many of us, the very first thing with fear is that we leave our body, we disconnect. See if you can feel your body, the throat, the chest, the belly. Be aware of the beliefs or thoughts that really are part of the trance of fear. What is it you believe when you're caught in some smallness, when your life gets contracted? It's usually something to do with what's wrong with me, what's not going to work out. Just sensing without reacting to it, just the emotions in the body of fear, in the trance of fear. And continue to be right here, but include sound in your awareness and a sense of this room. So you just sense the space of this room. And in your mind's eye, that you're sitting with several hundred people who are just sincerely beginning to be mindful of this trance, this universal conditioning that we humans have. So that as you recognize how the trance plays through your own body, mind, and sense it's happening for each of us in different ways, you can allow yourself to really feel the presence that's here, the one who knows, the one, that sense of beingness that's not hitched to or limited by a particular story or feeling. You are the awareness that's aware, the widening circle of being. Sense if you, rather than reacting, can just respond with kindness towards the trance of fear. Can you just offer the feelings and thoughts of fear a kind of space and kindness and presence? Instead of reacting from the fear, which is a trance, responding to the fear, which is awakening. And in the space of awakening, holding the fear that arises in all these bodies here in this room and in this world with a quality of kindness. Be empty of worrying. Think of who created thought. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. May our presence with fear liberate these hearts and reveal the love and awareness that's our true home. May the fear in this world be met with presence, and may that presence help to heal, to uplift, to bring awakening to all beings. Just close as we open tonight with a simple chanting of Om, that mantra of connectedness, the widening circles of being. Just to feel your heart, let's inhale deeply together.
Teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.